Today is July 28th, year 2000. This is the second interview with Helen Fisher Fry. We are doing the interview at her residence in Danville, Kentucky, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Well, thank you, Ms. Fry, for talking with me again. It's been, I believe we did the first interview in January of 1999, and of course then you were one of our feature speakers at the Civil Rights Symposium this past February, and we have been asked if we would come back and talk with you today about your experiences at the University of Kentucky, but I also have some other things I want to talk to you about. Does that sound okay with you?
That's fine.
Okay. Let's begin. As I recall from the interview that we did previously, you did your undergraduate work at Kentucky State University.
Correct. That's correct.
And then you eventually came back to be teaching at the Bates School here, which was the all-black school.
Correct.
And at what point, I know also you have, I believe I'm correct, you have master's degrees from Indiana University, and you also did some graduate work in school administration at Ohio State.
That's
and
right.
And then you did some, you have a master's from the University of Kentucky. Am I correct?
That's right.
Okay. I want to start, though. When did you first think about doing graduate work?
I finished Kentucky State in 1942, and I suppose about 1945, the wife of the local segregated Bates School, where I was teaching at the time, the wife was not a teacher. Her husband was the principal. And
but you got distracted.
Okay. We were at a meeting here in Danville, and the wife said to me, "When are you going to begin doing graduate work?" And I said, "I really hadn't thought of it." And she said, "Well, I'd like for you to get started." And I had one of my favorite teachers in high school who had attended Indiana University. She was one whom I admired very much, still a friend of mine living in Washington. And so I decided I would follow her and go to Indiana University. A former principal made the statement to me, "Why would you go to Indiana University? Don't you know Indiana is the most segregated, one of the most segregated, discriminating states? That the KKK is rampant in Indiana." Well, I did not know that, but I decided to follow through with my thinking, and I went to Indiana University. And I think some of the happiest days of my life were spent on the campus at Indiana University. Mm-hmm. I was really happy there.
Now, did you go during the summers, or did you take a break from school altogether and go
full-time? I went during the summer, but during the school year, once per week, commuted to Jeffersonville, Indiana, to the Extension, and took classes. And I was able to complete my master's work with 2 summers and the 1 year of commuting. So that was how I decided to start my graduate work.
Did you think at that time about applying to the University of Kentucky at all?
No. No. The state of Kentucky had, I guess you'd call them scholarships or funds for Kentucky students because they were not, according to the day law, were not permitted to attend any Kentucky school, undergraduate, graduate, right, college, grade school, nothing. The day law.
Right. And really, until 1949, the University of Kentucky on its campus would have been closed to anyone of color.
Correct.
But how about the correspondence program at that point?
I took one correspondence course in my life, a course in from University of Kentucky, and I don't remember the year, a course in French. But I don't care for correspondence courses. I like the classroom environment. Mm-hmm. And
do you think you would have taken that French course, though, before 1949?
I believe I took that course once I had sought entrance to the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I did not seek it prior to 1949. Okay.
So you received your master's degree from Indiana University. Then tell me about your education with Ohio State University.
Once I had such a beautiful experience on Indiana University campus, then going to Ohio State, I was a little bit let down. Ohio State is a little aloof. And Indiana University was concerned with the whole individual, the whole personality, well-rounded personality. And they provided all types of activities, recreational activities, social activities, in the arts, and really a well-rounded program. But Ohio State, purely academic. When class was over, there was nothing for you to do, and you had to make your own life. So I didn't, and I guess I'm a very social person. Mm-hmm. I'm a very private person with my own life, but there is that aspect of my personality. I like people. Mm-hmm. And I had good instructors there, one of the best instructors I had, and he was a wonderful person as an individual, but it's just the campus as a whole had that icy, aloof atmosphere that I didn't care for.
Well, again, now, were you there during the summer?
That was during the summer. I did all of my work during the summer, and except the commuting to Indiana University. At no time did I take a leave, mm-hmm, to attend full year. Okay.
And what were you studying at Ohio State?
At Ohio State, I was studying school administration.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you hadn't studied at Indiana University, because you did a master's in education there too, I believe?
I did my master's in secondary education. I had elementary education at Kentucky State and secondary education. And I got the idea from the original Bates School principal, Professor John Bates. He had a son who was one of the early African-Americans to get a doctorate degree, and I've forgotten from what school he received it. But at one time, Professor Bate made the statement that his son had broadened his education in a horizontal manner rather than a vertical manner, going straight up for his doctorate. He broadened it into areas, and so I like that idea. I'd rather know a little bit about a lot of things and think I was a doctorate in anything. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason I took secondary education at Indiana U. But the reason I took administration at Ohio State, I had been asked to take the principalship at Stanford, Kentucky, 10 miles away. Really wasn't interested, but I thought that, well, it would be good to be prepared just in case something came up in which I was interested. So that's why I took the administration. Mm-hmm. And I became certified with the state of Kentucky through that work.
How many courses were you required to take for certification? Do you remember?
I don't fully remember. Of course, in elementary education at Kentucky State, there are some courses in administration at the elementary level. I did not have any courses per se in administration at Indiana U. Mm-hmm. I probably took 3 courses, which would have been 9 or 10 mm-hmm. hours at Ohio State. And with what I already had, I was able to certify.
Right. Right. Okay. At what point did you begin to think about doing more graduate work at the University of Kentucky?
Well, the seed for my work at the University of Kentucky, the seed was sown really at Indiana University. When the Minimum Foundation program came into being in the state of Kentucky, I think that was under Mr. Burt Combs, Governor Combs. I'm not sure on that. But when that program came into being, the Minimum Foundation, which gave uniform structure to teacher salaries, simplified, there were about 4 levels, I think. At that point, I already had my master's degree, which gave me, and under the Minimum Foundation, I think the top pay, and I never worked for money. I worked for information and knowledge. I turned down several summer school jobs, working on the playground, whatever. Because I said I'd rather have my free time to participate in whatever activities I would like than to make money and not have time and get involved. So I took schoolwork instead of working to make money. However, when the Minimum Foundation came in, I think I was 13 hours short of being at the top level, which would have given me the top pay. And that's the only time I ever worked for money, really, truly. I took a pre-session at Indiana University in librarianship. I took the regular summer courses in librarianship, and I took the post session in librarianship. And so earning those R's qualified me to be in the top level.
Let me stop here. Those courses in library science were over and above or your master's degree.
Right.
So you went back and did more work at Indiana University.
Right.
to do these 13 courses that would put you at the top
13
level.
Hours.
13 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. This, you said Governor Combs, that the foundation, you think, that would have been late 50s, early 60s. Does that sound about right to you?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
I'm not, my husband can tell you the year anything happened, mm-hmm. and I can't tell you the year mm-hmm. anything happened.
Had to go back how many summers to do?
I did it all in one summer.
One summer. Oh, okay.
As I say, I did the pre-session, right. which was a two-week course before regular summer school. Mm-hmm. Then I did the regular, six-week summer school? Whatever regular summer school is. And then I did the post-session, which was another two-week course. Mm-hmm. And I earned the necessary hours to be in the top pay scale. And in the Danville system, there were only three persons who qualified for the top level. Mm-hmm. That was the superintendent of schools. Mm-hmm. There was a teacher at one of the white elementary schools, Ida Campbell, and myself. We were the three people in Danville who were at the top pay scale. But it was right there, and all I had to do was spend the summer and do it, so I just did it.
Mm-hmm. So were you thinking at that point about applying to the University of Kentucky? How did that come about?
All right, for the University of Kentucky, my first experience with the University of Kentucky was an extension class, which our superintendent of schools had held here in Danville for Danville teachers. Now, this was prior to the integration. Schools were still segregated. But it was an extension class here for Danville teachers, and our superintendent assumed that his teachers could attend. I attended the first class, as did others. On the second, before the second class session, the University of Kentucky notified the Danville superintendent that I think I'm a little bit, I've gone wrong in what I've said, because this was after the law that universities could be integrated, because they had interpreted it.
That would have been in 1949,
mm-hmm.
that the University of Kentucky, in a lawsuit that Lyman Johnson brought, mm-hmm. opened up the graduate school program
mm-hmm.
for attendance on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know about extension division.
Mm-hmm. You think? Well, this was immediately after that interpretation, and the university interpreted it that African Americans could attend the university interpreted it that African Americans could attend classes on campus but could not attend classes off campus, which seemed ridiculous. if they were going to do anything, they would integrate us off campus and not on campus. But
do you have any recollection of why they did that?
No, just retaining, maintaining, holding on to segregation any way they could.
Okay.
That's the way I regarded it. So before the second class session, they informed our superintendent that African Americans could not attend because of their interpretation, and that I could not attend the class. The superintendent would not let them notify me. He told them, I will notify her. I will not let you come to the school and notify her. So he came to the school, and they called me from my classroom, and he told me that I could no longer attend the class.
You were the only black teacher in that course.
In that class. Okay. There were two others from an adjacent county, but not from Danville. Of course, I had no recourse. All I could do was to drop out. And they said, above and beyond their interpretation, that I had not formally been accepted, because everyone in the class applied for admission, everyone who had not already done work at the UK, and there were others. We all filled in our applications the same night, the first night. And so the whites who applied at the same time that I could continue in the course. But I, as an African American, could not continue with the course because I was African American in their interpretation.
But they told you the reason was because your application wasn't complete.
That was one of the two reasons, because they interpreted it to mean we could only attend on campus, mm-hmm. and because right. my application okay. was not, I had not formally been accepted. I could not get any of those individuals, any of the white individuals, to testify to the fact that they too applied at the same time on the first night. Of course, nobody wanted to put themselves on the line at that time. And I did seek legal advice, but I decided not to pursue it, the legal recourse. It was written up in the Louisville Defender, an African American newspaper. Nothing was ever in the Courier. So with that, I could not attend the University of Kentucky. Near the end of the 1950s, maybe 56 or something. And after I had taken this course in library science, I really decided the library is where I want to be. I want to be with the books where I can read, and I just loved it because I kept my sixth grade teacher at that point. I kept my students doing reference work in the library, and then after school, I would often go down and spend extra time in the afternoon there in the library. So I just loved it. And there were rumblings about the integration, and in many places where they were integrated, African Americans were integrated out of the school. And many of them were going into the libraries. They put a lot of African American teachers in the library. And I just decided, well, I like it, and so I'm going to go f- for a degree. And at least I can remain here at home and have a job in the library. So that was my motivation for going on in. Plus, these courses that I took at Indiana University, it was just such a wonderful course. And they, every day they had different national and international literary personalities. One would fly in for a breakfast session, another one for a lunch session, another one, and you just got to meet more of the outstanding authors and illustrators, and I just was so fascinated with the course that that was more reason why I wanted to go into library science. So I decided to go on. Am I talking too much?
That's fine. No, you're doing good.
To go on, I said, well, I'm going to the University of Kentucky and see what they do with me. So I enrolled and was accepted, and I took courses. The first summer, I commuted from Danville, which was horrible, getting up at 5 o'clock and going over there and then waiting. I don't know why I was riding with someone else, because I was driving at that time, but I rode with another person, which extended my time waiting for them whenever they were ready. And I said, I'll never commute again. So the second summer, I decided to stay on the campus. And they put me in Jewel Hall. And they put me in a little room back behind the, I don't know what it was, the furnace or the hot water heater room. But I know I had to pass this heating room to get back to the little room where they put me as a accommodation. And it was hot as blazes, but I endured it. I stayed out of it as much as I could, only to sleep and dress. And the rest of the time I stayed in the library or someplace else. But
now, was your room in Jewel Hall any different than the rooms that the white students stayed in?
Well, no white student was back behind this little heater furnace room. And I don't know that there was another African American staying on the campus. I guess I was stupid for doing it, but I stayed there and endured it.
How were the other people in the dormitory? How did they treat you?
Oh, they didn't know I was there. There was no contact between them and me. They just didn't know I was there. And of course, summer school, each one is, there's more independence than there is in regular school anyway.
How about your classes?
The classes.
You were taking classes in library science?
In library science. Mm-hmm. And let's see, I can recall Miss Martin was head of the library science department at that time. There was an elderly lady, Miss Wofford, who was a teacher. There was a Miss Letcher.
I'm going to ask you to stop so I can turn the tape over, please.
Completed all of my classwork. And was to take orals before I could qualify for graduation. Three instructors that I can remember. Miss Wofford, the elderly lady, I was just another individual in her class, and I had no complaints about her class whatsoever. But Miss Martin and I'm saying Letcher, and that doesn't sound exactly right. They showed their prejudice one way or another. I mean, it was just perfectly obvious in instructing and questioning and so forth. They would come down the row asking questions, and when they would get to me, they would skip over me and ask the next person. It was very obvious, but I guess I expected it. I knew it wouldn't be a rose garden, and I didn't complain. I just went right on and did my work. I made acceptable grades. There was no question to my grading. But in the classroom situation, I was discriminated against. For instance, of course, I was going for a master's degree in library science, and I had to take a course in test and measurements for a master's. And that was under Miss Letcher. And I had had test and measurements at Indiana U to get that master's degree. Of course, I had to give my transcript to the University of Kentucky for everything I'd had elsewhere. And they knew I had had test and measurements, and I took this course. And somewhere down the line, Miss Letcher said to me, "So, I didn't know you had test and measurements. You should not have had to repeat that." And she was the one who required it of me. So I had the same course twice, once at Indiana and once at repeat at the University of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Just a little petty, mm-hmm. discriminatory mm-hmm. acts. I completed all of my class work. Was to take orals before I could qualify for graduation. And I just decided I'm not going to take the orals. They gave me credit for my classwork, and I earned it. But taking orals is such a subjective experience. They can fail me. They can do anything they want to do. And I'm through. I've taken my coursework, and that's all that I needed. And I didn't need a degree mm-hmm. to get a job, just the coursework. So I stopped. They wrote me asking me when would I like to take my orals, and I didn't even answer. I had no contact with them going from me to them. They wrote me several times. Then they wrote and said, "We have, if one wants an extension of time, one has to request it." Mm-hmm. I didn't request it. They wrote me that they had automatically extended my time. I didn't respond. And I went, I don't know, a year or a year and a half. And the YWCA was having a reception on UK campus. And two Danville citizens, two white ladies, I've been well accepted in Danville all of my life. No problems in Danville. And these two white ladies asked me to accompany with them to this YWCA reception and whatever at UK. At the reception was the head of the Department of Library Science. It was different from Miss Martin, who was head of the department when I first started. They had a changeover. And I was a very nice person. And I had a feeling he was going to say something to me. And so I avoided him in the crowd. I avoided him. I would see him coming in my direction, and I would go in another direction. He finally walked up behind me, and he said, "You've been avoiding me." I said, "Yes." And he said, "When are you coming to take your orals?" I said, "Never." And he, of course, said, "Why?" And I told him that I had been discriminated against throughout the time, and I knew they could fail me, because people do fail their orals. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's such a subjective thing, and I'm not going to let that happen to me, so I'm not going to take them. And so I don't know how much longer I waited, and then I decided, I guess I grew up a little bit, matured a little bit, and I said, I'm going over there and let them fail me. So I contacted them and made the appointment and went over and went through the orals. And of course, after it's over, you go out while they decide what your fate will be. And that's the first time I broke down, sitting out there waiting. I just broke down, cried, and I started to leave. I was ready to leave, and when they come out, I would be gone. But I decided, no, my better judgment. And, of course, they came out, asked me when I went in. These very people who had skipped over me and so forth were hugging me, congratulating me. To me, that was a lot of hypocrisy, but I accepted it. And went on and received it. I said, I've gone this far, so I'm going to march. And I did the whole nine yards.
So you went through the graduation ceremony.
I did.
And do you remember what year that might have been?
I think that was 1960.
Okay.
I guess I don't.
Were there any other students of color in the library science courses when you were taking them?
Yes, there were a few, very few. I know one lady from Lexington whom I knew, who was working at that time, and she did not begin as early as I did. And when she got ready to do her oral, she said, "Please let me have your notes," mm-hmm. and all my classroom notes. And I remember one other young person who was younger than I, but I don't remember any. I had no contact with any. I had very little contact. Of course, there weren't too many mm-hmm. at that point mm-hmm. Who were going, and fewer still in library science, because most of them were in education. Mm-hmm. So I didn't come in contact with too many African Americans.
Have you had opportunity to stay in touch with the program in any way over the years to sort of see how it, if there have been any changes? Or?
Not really, not really. I went to a few programs and seminars in the early years, but I did not keep contact with them.
Okay. Did you become a librarian after that?
Yes, yes. Before integration, I came out of the classroom and then went into the library. I was teaching sixth grade, and I love teaching, and I love the children. I love the activities. But my philosophy is, to properly evaluate, you have to have a lot of written work. Mm-hmm. And there are more classes, more texts, more areas in the sixth grade than in any other level, I think, in school. I mean, you had a book in democracy and beside all of the basics, and of course there was geography and special spelling. I guess you had 8 or 9 different subjects. And even in spelling, you have written work, and of course in English and social studies, geography and history and everything. And I got so tired of grading papers every night. And if you don't grade them and give them back, it's an injustice. And I burned out. I really burned out grading papers. And that was one of the reasons I came. But I sort of was defeated going into library science. I thought, now I can read. But instead, it was processing books and counting cards. And of course, it was a 12th grade school at that point. And with 12 grades and at some levels, there were 2 classrooms, like first grade, you had 2 first grades or something like that. So I really didn't get to read as much as I would like to have, but it was more stimulating, it was more satisfying, and even going to the library meetings throughout the year was just wonderful, and I've never regretted that I went into library science.
So in the early years of after you got your degree, there was a state library association and there were meetings. Talk about that a little bit. You said going to the library meetings. Were those statewide meetings or?
I have no knowledge of the organization at this point. I know I see very little in print about it, but I probably miss it. But we had a district, Central Kentucky Education Association, which met each October. I don't know whether that's still in existence or not, because it came to the point where the teachers didn't want to attend, and it came to the point that they didn't have to attend. So I don't know what the situation is now. But at the point when I was there, school was out and you had to attend. And then it came to the point if you did not want to attend, you could stay at the building and do work planning and so forth. But I always attended. At the district level, I finally became chairman of the librarians section. First I was secretary, and then I became chairman.
At that point, was it an all-black group?
No. It was integrated. It was integrated. I guess I opened my mouth when I should keep it closed. So I served in that capacity. Then at the State Librarian Association, which always was at
it's
in Louisville.
Right.
Great. Mm-hmm. I was secretary of the state KLA, Kentucky Library Association. I was secretary of that. And I attended and kept up with meetings for some while, even after I retired, but then I finally just. Mm-hmm. So I really, as I say, I don't know whether those organizations, I don't know the status now.
Have you been active in the UK Alumni Association in any way?
No. I had membership a few times. Mm-hmm. But active, no.
Did you go to any events that they held?
There is a local, And I have been, the local, I think, maybe meets twice per year. And I went to one or two meetings of the local, but to be active, no. Last year, in August, the University of Kentucky had a program observing the integration, and all of the, I suppose all of students, I don't know if it was of that period or what, but they were invited back. And Desmond Tutu was the speaker. And so I attended that very nice meeting, the big program over in, oh, it's the girls' gymnasium,
Memorial
Memorial.
Coliseum.
Is that Memorial? The old gymnasium.
I'm not sure. That's where Bishop Tutu spoke
Spoke.
at Memorial, as I know
Memorial Auditorium.
it.
Well, that was
In the Coliseum, like it's a big
Coliseum. It's called the
gymnasium,
Coliseum.
Coliseum.
And I attended that. I can't put my finger on it, but I had a picture made with Desmond Tutu. And the Danville Advocate has always been receptive to my concerns. And whenever I want to get in anything in the paper, I have no trouble getting it in when I want it, where I want it, and so forth. And so I took that picture of myself and Desmond Tutu, and they put it in the Danville paper. But that's the extent of my contacts with UK. Now, they do have this organization of African American graduates, I suppose. And they have written me when they have their observance at homecoming. They have, the African Americans have a separate observance from what the college has, but I've never participated in any of them. I believe in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and I am an integrationist. I mean, I don't want to be white. I don't want to be any fair-skinned African American than I am. That is a problem with African Americans, you know, the color, the light skin against the dark skin. But I've been pleased with who I am and what I am. But I just feel if it's the university observance of homecoming and anything else, they should all be together. Of course, not some of the activities have a purpose, and I probably should participate more than I do, but I just don't.
I want to go back and ask you when the schools in Danville were integrated. Of course, we had the Supreme Court decision, the Brown decision in 54, and then the implementation decision the next year. But how long did it take before integration actually happened here? And how did it happen?
The chairman of the Board of Education at that time, I suppose early on when the decision was made, was Rector Newland of the Episcopal Church. He was chairman of the board.
Rector?
Rector. I think you called the
Rector. Oh, rector. Rector.
rector.
Right. Okay.
Rector.
Rector Newland. Right. Okay.
And he was, I will say, a very broad-minded Christian man. And I don't don't know how I get, well, one thing, I get into so many activities that if something is going on, and it's in Danville or Louisville or wherever, and I have a concern, an interest in whatever it is, if I'm going to learn about it, I go. I go alone anywhere I want to go if there's something I want to learn. So if something's going on at one of the churches and it's in the paper and I think I'd like to hear it, I just go, and always have. So somehow I became very, Rector Newland, his wife, and I were very friendly. And when he was having a special activity at his church, he would call and tell me. And there have been times that he and his wife have come to my home and gotten me and taken me to the church. I know at one time my mother was ill, and they were having a laying on of hands. And so he knew my mother was ill, I don't know why. And he came for me to go to that service as a strengthening experience.
So he was the chair of the school board at the time of integration. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there were a series of meetings in Danville for the public to get their input, and there was opposition, but there were no demonstrations of any kind, and there was no confrontations or anything. But he worked diligently with it and with the public, and they had several different approaches to integration. I think the first one was any high school student who wanted to go from Bate, the African American school, to the Danville High School could go. It was just volunteer.
And they could go for the full course, not just a selected
Right, for the, they could enroll
right, okay.
there.
Full time.
Mm-hmm. And we had some who did at the very beginning, who enrolled and who graduated from Danville High School. I don't know how long. They continued that. They never did discontinue. Once they opened, anyone could go, could attend.
And then, you think they did that fairly soon after the Supreme
yes,
Court decision?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Then after a few years, a different approach was used in addition to the high school. They started with the elementary grades, integrating, starting with first, second, and third, and then fourth, fifth, and sixth. And once they were integrated, that was it. They were cut out at the Bates School. Those grades were eliminated, and they were integrated. And it was through the end, it ended up with all of the high school was gone. And the first, second, and third were gone. And finally, in 1964, I think, they integrated the entire Danville system. And
what happened to the actual physical Bates School?
School. Well, when in 64, when they integrated all of the schools, they turned the Bates building into the city middle school. And that building remained the Bates Middle School for a good 10 years. And then they decided to build a totally new plant on the same location. So they built a new building further back. I don't know whether you know where the school is now. On Stanford Road. So they built a new plant behind the original school. And once it was completed, the move was made to the new building, and the old building was razed. That old building was first, the first original 8 rooms were built in 1912. And then there were 2 additions made to it. One, I think, was about 1929, and then the other one was later. I've forgotten the year. It was not a bad structure.
In some communities today, even, the students who attended the all-black school still get together occasionally with families. They have reunions, and sometimes they have them in their hometown, and sometimes they have them all over the country. Is there anything like that here at
yes.
the Danville school system?
Bates School former students decided to form an alumni association for the high school. And they did. At first they met every 3 years, I think. And then they decided to meet every 2 years. And there's a controversy. They still want to keep it for the high school. This year they are finding out more than ever that the numbers are dwindling, and there just aren't any more. And there is the sentiment that they would like it for any person who attended Bay School. And of course, the time's going to come, that will be over. In the meantime, there was a group of whites who wanted to organize an alumni association for all Danville school, high school graduates. So that would take in all Danville high school graduates from zero till now, and all Bates school graduates from zero till now. And I worked with the formation of that organization, and they had a meeting, I think it was last weekend, and I was to have been in it, but of course I couldn't participate.
Because you've broken your leg recently, right?
Okay. And I worked with the formation and organization of it. Then the Bates School alumni group will meet the 4th and 5th, I think it is, of August coming up.
I imagine a lot of those people who attended Bates School live outside of Danville at this point in time.
Absolutely. And it has been well attended, beautifully executed, well organized. It's been a beautiful experience. But now, at the time that I finished Bates School in 1938, finished high school. At that point, our class was the largest class that had graduated. After that time,
was how many people? How many people in your graduating class?
About, I think it was 29 or 30. But there were larger classes after that point. But right now, as we try to count, there are only 4 persons out of our class who are living.
I want to ask you, Ms. Fry, in your years as both a student and a teacher in the all-black schools, how much black history do you think you were introduced to by your teachers?
I don't know at what level, what grade I first became aware of black history, Negro history, we called it.
Right.
And we had the Negro History Week originally, and then it expanded to the month of February. But the most in-depth study of African American history that I got at Bates School was in the 7th and 8th grade. We had a teacher, a Mrs. Melindy Donahue.
Can you spell Donahue for me?
D-O-N-E-G-H-Y.
Okay.
Melinda. She was the best informed and the most stimulating, inspiring, motivating teacher I ever had. She inspired me. Of course, I got my first inspiration to look, to know, to learn, to study, to be aggressive at home from my mother.
Did your parents ever teach you any Negro history?
No. No.
They taught you?
My memory and introduction to Negro history was really at that 7th and 8th grade level. So not only did I not get it at home, wasn't getting it any place. So to me, Negro history was from the 1934 on is when I first became aware of Negro history.
Do you remember, and I know this is hard to think back to all of that, but do you remember what topics were taught in Negro history? What people did you learn about? Was it all Negro history in America, or did it go back to Africa?
Did not go back to Africa. It was in the current at that time and the immediate past, but it did not go back to Africa. Well, even in our regular history book, there might have been not a chapter, but a few sentences about slavery in America, but not a chapter. And we did not get too much on slavery. Well, I won't go into that. It was something else I was going to say about, but I won't take time. But we did get in depth on individuals. It was more a listing, enumeration of African Americans who had made contributions and what contribution they made.
Do you remember any of them that you learned about then?
Oh, my. Of course, there was Harriet Tubman and Crispus Attucks, and
probably Booker T. Washington.
Oh yes, Booker T. Washington and Frederick Douglass, and
when the schools became integrated, and the black children moved into predominantly white school systems and teachers and whatnot. What happened to the teaching of Black history in the beginning?
Of course, I was not in the classroom. And I was at Bates School. I remained at Bates School even with the new building. And there were always African-American.
We're having quite a storm here with lightning and thunder, if the transcriber hears that.
Does the weather bother you? Does lightning and thunder bother you?
It's a little close, though, right now. Are you okay?
Shall I draw the shade?
No.
All right.
You okay? We can.
I'm all right.
Okay.
All right. Let's see, where was I?
We're talking about after integration to what
the teaching
in the beginning, at least, was in Black history.
At Bates School, and I suppose those teachers who were in the former white schools carried it with them, because there were always African-American teachers in the social studies at the high school. And so they taught in their classes voluntarily. There was nothing mandatory about it. Now, at the middle school level, and I was librarian, I was asked by my principal to teach a two-week course. At the middle school, they had lots of two-week courses and four-week courses, and so I was asked to teach a course in African-American history at the middle school level for that.
Teaching to the students?
To the students.
Okay.
Teaching to the students. The students came enrolled on a volunteer basis. I hate to tell you this, but I really had more white students to enroll in the course than I did African-American students. Of course, I guess percentage-wise, it was about equal, but I did expect more of the African-American students than
this,
did.
This would have been in the 60s?
Yes. Yes, because it was integrated in 64, so this was in the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
I retired in 80, so it was in the 60s and 70s.
When you got ready to teach the course, where did you go for resources? Did you feel like there was enough information out there for you to teach the course, or?
Yes, I did not go. Of course, none of the colleges at that point were teaching classes in African American history. They later established courses, and I think some of them maybe have. I don't think any have a degree in it. But I had resources there in the library. We had some material on it, so I had resources. And at that time, bookstores were bringing material on, and I bought material. The newspapers, and then there were African-American publications, Ebony Magazine, and other publications. So I had enough material for this middle school level.
Okay. Well, I think that's about all that I knew ahead of time that I wanted to ask you. Is there anything you want to add?
I can't think of anything at this point of anything that I would like to add.
Have you continued your interest in African American history?
Not as much so as I would like to have.
Of course, you served on the African American Heritage Commission.
Right. And I've been involved in so many community activities here in Danville. For instance, I was chairman of the public housing here in Danville, and I still stay involved in whatever goes on at City Hall. I go to see participate.
I remember when we talked in January of 99, you were working on a preservation project of some sort then.
I would like for you to, I would like whenever you're in Danville, and if I weren't in my cast,
and weather worked like
and
it
yes,
is,
and the weather. I would like to take you and show you this house that we restored. This house, we think, is the oldest house built by an African American. He was, an indentured slave, and before 1845, he built this house, and it stayed in his family line from that time till 1929. And then a former high school teacher at the Bates School, I think she was the first teacher hired when Professor John Bates came to Danville from Louisville and organized the first public school for African Americans in Danville. And she was the first teacher he hired, I think. And her father was a Methodist minister. And they bought this dorm sled house. And they were the second owners of it. And she lived in that house until 1990 or 90 something. And she was getting ready to go to Sunday school on Sunday morning, 104 years old, and died there in the house. And we had an organization, really two organizations of Negro women's clubs, and had houses, what they call their federation homes here in Danville. And for reasons, economic basically, they had bought one, sold another, and had three different houses. And at that point, the one that we had was inadequate, so they bought the dorm sled house and restored it. So it's, but the organization itself is about to fall apart, and I don't know what's going to happen to the house, but
it's
there.
Is anybody living in the house?
No, it's just, we have an apartment upstairs, which we hoped to rent as sort of a caretaker. But if you don't know about rental property, you have to be more than selective in whom you put in it. And since this is historical as well as rental, we have to be more than careful. And we just haven't found anyone that wants to move into it under our requirements and so forth. So it's there. We have a meeting there once or twice per month. But I'd love for you to see it.
Well, I'd love to. Tell me what the women's organizations, the names of them that worked on this.
There are two women's clubs. The older of the two was organized in 1898. We observed our 100th anniversary year before last.
And the name?
It's called the Domestic Economy Club, organized by our four parents in 1898, and their interest was economy in the home. And they met from home to home. That was their social life, because there were no places out for social life. So meeting at that club once per month was the big thing in their lives. Mm-hmm. And they were to entertain on a maximum of $1 per meeting. Iced tea and homemade cookies or something.
Now this was purely a local organization.
Yes. Okay. The domestic economy was purely local.
Right.
But early over into the 20th century, they, along with and communities, towns, cities all over, not just the state, the nation. Mm-hmm. The African-American women had these clubs. Mm-hmm. And
They usually called domestic economy
clubs? No, each one
had a different name.
Chose its own name.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Early in the 20th century, there was another one formed, and there they were called the Busy Sunshine Club. Mm-hmm. So those are the two. Mm-hmm. And they joined together. Basically, they were social. That was their social life, with some limited civic interest. Then these two local clubs joined together in the Federation of Women's Clubs here in Danville. And it was under this Federation of Women's Clubs that we bought this house. And they did a lot more then than we're doing now. The African American funeral home here in Danville is now in the first house that the Federation owned. It was a former big, I guess they were farmers then. Mm-hmm. Big, huge, big brick mansion. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the Federation was able to buy it. Those women worked and were able to buy it. And in that building, and that was back in the early 20th century, they formed together to do humanitarian work. Social was not just enough. And they formed what they called an old folks' home. And in that house, they took in ill, older, elderly African Americans who had no place to go. And someone, I don't know who, brought me a record book from the early history, a secretary's book, that was found. This person said it came out of the courthouse in Stanford, and we just don't know how it got there. Mm-hmm. But that book gives a lot of the history. Mm-hmm. And early in this old folks home, the county court gave to that home, I think it was between $10 and $15 per month for each person. So they were doing a lot more then than they're doing now. Mm-hmm. But now that our young people, they can go any place they want to, they can do anything they want to, the government is taking care of the old elderly and the dying and all that, we can't get enough young people interested enough to keep it going.
Right. Well, next time I come to visit, maybe you'll be up and about at that point, and I'd love to see the house.
I want you to see it before something happens.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how we're going to maintain it. I mean, the young people just aren't. They just out of the organization.
Right.
They're doing nothing.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
One other project that we have had here in Danville, prior to the restoration of the dorm sled house that I just talked about, there is in Danville a log cabin. It was a residence, a rental residence of one of the Danville citizens. And when urban renewal came through that area, and we're going to raise the house, Cecil Doolin Wallace, who was a historian known statewide and nationwide, and who died a little over a year or two ago and left, was deeply involved in restoration statewide, the Perryville Project, and much in the state of Kentucky.
The Perryville Project.
Yes, okay. The restoration of Perryville and the Perryville battlefield and so forth. She discovered that this house was a log cabin in this urban renewal area, and she called a group of African Americans together, and we formed an organization for the restoration of the house. She dug into the history and found that a Civil War, let me see, was it Civil or was it Revolutionary? I believe it was Revolutionary War. Captain Craddock.
Craddock,
C-R-A-D-D-O-C-K, I think, had built this house for himself. Mm-hmm. And he had houses, property, I think in Bowling Green and one or two other areas in central Kentucky.
Now, he was white or black?
He was white.
Okay.
A white Revolutionary War captain. Mm-hmm. And he was a slaveholder. Excuse me. And when he died, he willed this house here in Danville to one of his slaves. Willis Russell, a slave. The log cabin was a two-story house. Mm. Which at that time was sort of a luxury. And of course, as a captain in the war, he could afford a luxurious cabin. This Willis Russell took in, even though it was just it was two rooms, the upstairs was really a room and a half, which made it almost three rooms. This Willis Russell, the Negro slave who was will this cabin, took in African American boys and girls and formed a school. And according to our history that we have garnered, it was the first school for African Americans west of the Allegheny Mountains. Mm-hmm. So Miss
Now this would have been before or after the Civil War?
Afterwards.
He did the school, the first school.
Uh-huh. I think it was after the Civil War. I think I have notes on it, but right now. But I think it was
in many Southern states. Though of course there were laws that prohibited you from teaching blacks.
Right, right. But and of course, Craddock did not do the teaching. It was after Willis Russell, the slave,
right,
was willed the house that Willis Russell
did
the teaching.
Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't know whether it was even forbidden then, and whether he did it secretly, I don't know. But
what a wonderful find, though. What a wonderful find.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. And Cecil Doolin Wallace got the group of African Americans together and formed an organization, and we restored that log house, and we got grants, and my husband and I worked very hard at raising funds for the restoration and supervising it, and it's there, and we're not doing what we should be doing with it, because we restored it with the idea of making an African American museum. And I had hoped that we could put a genealogical bank upstairs and have a museum on the first floor. We have done nothing with our original plans, but it is still there. They have it rented now, but I'm living in hopes that it will really be used as a historical site. It's referred to very often by David Morgan. He worked with us beautifully in both restorations, and we had grants, multiple grants, in the restoration of these two buildings. Right now, there is a third building, the Masonic Lodge building, that we got one grant for, but the lodge itself is in turmoil, and it's on hold right now. But it is in the downtown restoration area, and we're hoping to get some action.
Well, you sound very passionate to me about all of this, which is African American history in preservation.
I'm not promoting myself.
No. You sound very excited about it, and I understand that.
And yet I'm disturbed about it.
Right.
I'm deeply disturbed. And I can't get this enthusiasm to rub off. And of course my interest in the Masonic Hall is, what shall I say, misplaced and out of order, because the Masonics even don't let their auxiliary women have too much voice. And I've been pushing, but I've gotten nowhere, and they aren't doing anything. But I'm hoping.
Well, next trip, I hope you'll give me a tour.
I'd love to.
Places.
I would love to.
Thank you.